trying to find a picture of a dog due to aesthetic.
Or an ox.
Or an ox due to aesthetic, which unfortunately I failed to do, but I did find this, which... Ninja nuns. She looks pretty determined. No, she is a nun of some kind. Anglican Southern Italy is being shut down after a quarrel among its last three remaining nuns ended in blows. Sisters Anna Maria and Gia Battista reportedly upset about their mother's superior's authoritarian ways, scratched her in the face and threw her to the ground. In an incident in July that was kept quiet until now. So there you go. I've got a Christian blog I came across looking at. I had this, this thing as well. It's quite cool, isn't it? It means for 3 years the priest would eat a special diet consisting of only nuts and seeds while taking part in a regimen of rigorous physical activity that stripped them of their body fat. Then they ate only bark and roots for another 3 years and began drinking a poisonous tea made from the sap of the urushi tree, which contains urushio, the same stuff that makes poison ivy, normally used to lack up bowls. This caused vomiting and a rapid loss of bodily fluids. Finally, a self-mummifying monk would lock himself in a stone tomb barely larger than his body, where he would not move from the lotus position. Venerable Metabar's nodding in agreement. You don't have any plans, I hope.
Because of Vietnam, there are monks
like that. Like that?
But my teacher said he poisoned.
He poisoned?
Yes.
Was killed, you mean?
No.
Somebody killed them,
yeah.
Huh?
No, that they're ingesting slime.
His only connection to the outside world would be an air tube and a bell. Each day he rang a bell to let those outside know that he was still alive. When the bell stopped ringing, the tube was removed and the tomb was sealed. Not all monks who attempted self-mummification were successful, but the payoff for the ones who succeeded was quite high. They were raised to the status of Buddha, put on display and tended to by their followers. The Japanese government outlawed Sokushunbutsu in the late 19th century, although the practice continued into the 20th.
Wow.
So we have a monograph here on the Buddhist mummies, human mummies of Taiwan, which is various cases where monks have died and then their bodies have seemingly been preserved or something and they haven't rotted. But in those cases, it just seemed to be that's how it went. They didn't actually deliberately prepare themselves and facilitate the process. It just seemed to happen. So there you go. So that might have an indirect bearing, not necessarily a completely direct bearing, but an indirect bearing on the content of the sutta today, sutta, which is all about kind of weird and extreme ascetic practices. Not that I'm wishing to express any criticism of those good venerables who decided that was the fastest way to become a Buddha. Nevertheless, we will see the Buddha's attitude towards these kind of practices in Majjhima Nikaya number 57. Ooh.
The M ending.
Oh, you have to come to the Pali class on Thursday to have all the esoteric secrets will be revealed. It's actually a M, not an M, and it's a doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it's just forms the ending or the final word of quite a lot of the most common cases in Pali grammar. So there's not just one case that looks like that. There's actually quite a few different ones that end with the n sound.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most common being the accusative case, just meaning the object of the verb. But also many others are found with that. So, this particular sutta, concerns Sainya, the naked dog duty ascetic, and Purna, the ox duty ascetic, who went to see the Buddha and talked to him about the virtues of practicing in that way. Of course, this being some of the kind of many different kinds of bizarre bizarre practices dreamt up by Indian ascetics, and it seems also Japanese ascetics have their so. According to Venerable Anālaya, this particular sutta is one of the few suttas in the Pali Canon that does not have a direct parallel in the Chinese Agamas, or indeed in any other Sanskrit or other versions. Nevertheless, just read from Venerable Anālaya's discussion here. The four kinds of actions discussed in the Kukuravatika Sutta, which we will look at a bit in a little while, recur in a discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya, while the Kukuravatika Sutta concludes its exposition of the first three types of actions with a general statement on the relation of action to the rebirth of beings, indicating that beings are the heirs of their karma. The Anguttara Nikaya presentation of the same four types of action does not have such a statement. So he's merely pointing out a difference in the form between the presentation in the Majjhima version and the Anguttara version.
Mm-hmm.
An exposition of the four kinds of action can also be found as a sutra quotation in the Shamatha Deva's commentary on the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya, and that's called the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya Bhashyo Payika Nama Tika. Do you want me to say that again?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's actually the Abhidharma Kosho Paika Nama Pika, something like that. I didn't make it up either.
Isn't it fortunate that we realise that nothing stays the same?
Yeah, Abhidharma Kosho Paika Nama Pika, which is a commentary written by Shamatha Deva about, I think, 8th century or something like that. Just to recap a little bit on that commentary, I probably mentioned it previously, but it is actually a very interesting text which exists only in Tibetan. And if you know anything about the development of later Buddhism, you'd know that the Abhidharma Kosha became an extremely influential philosophical text in later Buddhism, written by Vasubandhu from a Sautrantika perspective. And it became the standard text for the Abhidharma studies, which Abhidharma studies in the northern schools is not so much of a specialized thing as it became in the Theravada, and Abhidharma remained more kind of rooted in normal Dhamma in the northern schools than it did in the Pali, where it became exceedingly specialized. So this particular text, the Abhidharma Kosha, gives some succinct verses summarizing the teachings, And then the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya is the Vasubandha's own commentary on his text. So first of all, he wrote the text. He actually wrote it on request of a certain Sangabhadra in Kashmir who asked him to please write a text on Abhidharma. He wrote it. He sent it. They said back saying, "That is very nice. It's a very good text, but it's very difficult to understand. So could you please write us your own commentary on your text?" Which he did. But when he wrote his commentary, he refuted all the doctrines of the Kashmiri school. And so he did it as a deliberate trick. So first of all, he buttered them up by writing a text which he knew that they would like, and then he refuted all their doctrines in his own commentary and wrote it back. And Sangabhadra was very upset with him and described his teachings as being as coherent as the ravings of a mad deaf mute in a fever dream. So... and so that particular text, the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya, is the main Abhidharma text that's always been in both China and Tibet and is still regularly studied today. Now that contains a large number of quotes and references to suttas, which are, generally speaking, those of the Sarvastivadin school generally, although it's not exactly sure which precise part of the Sarvastivadin school that Vasubandha was using. But in Tibetan, you have this book by Shamatadeva, which then takes all of those references and half-quotes and so on to sutta passages and then gives all the sutta passages in full. And quotes and often says, and as it says in sutta such and such of the Majjhima Nikaya such and such such and such, and then gives the quote all in full detail. And so it's actually a major source. Sorry?
That's valuable.
It is very valuable, yeah. And that's a major source of sutta material from the Tibetan tradition. And it seems Analio's theory on that is that when Vasubandhu was writing, he probably assumed that his audience was already familiar with the Agama Sutras. But by the time that Buddhism went to Tibet, which was 400 or 500 years later, the study of the Agamas was already in decline. And so Shamatadeva, when introducing this text, perhaps specifically written to take to Tibet, because they didn't have Agama translations, he then had to compile the list of quotes from the Agama Sutras so that they would be able to understand the Abhidharma Kosha. And it's quite a nice theory, and one of the things that it emphasizes is how essential it is if you want to understand Abhidharma, or meaning later, basically Abhidharma in the sense of later philosophical Buddhism of any school, that you really need to have a basis on the study of the Agamas, and that means the early suttas first. Otherwise, you will just get misled. So, that's just a background on what this thing is. So, one of the things that this particular text, the Abhidharma Kosha Upayika Nama Pika, has is a quote from which has also the four types of action, which, as we just mentioned before, is found both in the Majjhima version here and also in the Anguttara Nikaya. But the version found in the, I'll call it a Shamatadeva after the author, and Shamatadeva's work is more similar to the Majjhima Nikaya version, the Kukkuravatika Sutta, than it is to the Anguttara version. So Analio then suggests that implies that the Shamatadeva was working from a version of our present sutta known to the northern traditions. Similarly, in the Chinese Sanghiti Pariyaya, now the Sanghiti Pariyaya is an extended commentary, Abhidhamma book, which comments on the sutta called the Sanghiti Sutta. So in the Digha Nikaya we have a sutta called the Sanghiti Sutta, which assembles a whole list of doctrinal categories, the threes of this and the fours of this and so on and so on, and it assembles them all. And in the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma, then one of the Abhidharma works took all those doctrinal categories and then quoted the sutta references and comments on them. And in the Chinese translation of that, that only exists in Chinese translation, the Chinese translation also has the four types of action, and in there it mentions Purna, who who's one of the protagonists of the Kukuravatika Sutta, and moreover specifies that he was an observer of the cow conduct. This indicates that even though the Chinese arguments did not preserve a parallel to the Kukuravatika Sutta, the compilers of the Sangiti Pariyaya were well acquainted with a version of this discourse. The present instance then serves to reinforce the point already made in relation to the Jivaka Sutta, namely that conclusions based on the absence of a discourse from the Chinese agamas need to be made with considerable caution. So the point of all that is simply to say that even though we don't have a version of this particular sutta in existing in the agamas, nevertheless it seems that at one time it did, and that the reason it is not found today is not because it was a later invented sutta or a particular product of the Pali school, but simply to do with the vagaries of transmission of the agamas into Chinese and Tibetan and so on. So actually, I should just, before I go on, I should just double check that, because seeing if this sutta was found in the new Diga Agama. It's just been found in Afghanistan, but it seems not. Okay, so on to the sutta. That's what I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Kaulian country, where there was a town of the Kaulians named Halidavasana, Kaulia being the family of the Buddha's mother. Is that right? Maya. Yeah, Kaulia was Maya was from the Kaulian clan, and this is the clan that claimed to be living in the Sujata village and some of the other villages in Bodh Gaya over the river. They call themselves the Kauriyas, and they actually claim to be descended from the Kaulia clan of Maya. True or not, I don't know. Then Purna, son of the Kaulians, an ox-duty ascetic, and also Senya, a naked dog-duty ascetic, went to the Blessed One. Purna, the ox-duty ascetic, paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down at one side, while Senya, the naked dog-duty ascetic, exchanged greetings with the Blessed One, and when the courteous and amiable talk was finished, he too sat down at one side, curled up like a dog. So notice the two different ways of greeting the Buddha, and this of course is a shorthand way of expressing the different people's attitude towards the Buddha. So some of them, the govatiko, the cow duty, okay, or ox duty, he abhivadetva, having bowed down to the Blessed One, and the dog duty, the kukuravatiko, exchange pleasant greetings, okay. So obviously a less devoted attitude towards the Buddha. Purna, the ox-duty ascetic, said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, this Senya is a naked dog-duty ascetic who does what is hard to do. He eats his food when it is thrown to the ground. He has long taken up and practiced that dog duty. What will be his destination? What will be his future course? What is his gati, his future destination? Gati, like a destiny, his going, literally his going. And what it is abhisamparaya, where does he go after he passes away?" So, I guess I've probably told this story before, but should be told is that if you think that nobody does these things, then I read a number of years ago in the newspaper, there was a story of somebody who was putting on an exhibition of performance art in the New York Museum of Modern Art. And he was a Russian fellow, performance artist. And when he got off the plane, as soon as he came through the customs, he threw off all his clothes and got down on the ground like a dog and started barking. And then they had to put a collar around him and a leash and take him off. And they put him in as an installation in the New York Museum of Modern Art. And there he stayed for a couple of weeks, just sort of curled up in the corner and barking at people when they went past and eating his food from a bowl and doing his business there and all of these kinds of things. So, well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly
one
yeah. So,
happens.
So someone may well have wondered, what is his destination? What will be his future course? So the Buddha's answer: enough puna, alang puna, alang enough. Tetta dang, tetta means just put it to one side. Do not ask me that.
We can use that word in the kitchen.
Alang. Yeah, alang puna. Ma expresses a prohibition. Don't. Second time and a third time, puna, the ox duty said to the Blessed One. And the Blessed One replied, well, puna, since I certainly cannot persuade you when I say enough puna, let that be. Do not ask me that, I shall therefore answer you. Okay. Okay. Right. Here, Puna. Somebody develops a dog duty fully and uninterruptedly. He develops a dog habit fully and uninterruptedly. So the kukara vata. So this is the vata. It's the same word that's found in sila vata paramasa. We usually translate as attachment to rites and rituals. Okay. But the word vata, as we see here, it doesn't really mean a ritual, it means a vow or a duty. Okay, so the vata is a vow. Somebody's undertaken this vow. Kukura silang bhaveti. So he develops the sila of a dog. Okay, so here sila, again, we usually use in the sense of morality or ethics, but it actually has a more broader context. And Bhikkhu Bodhi's translated as habit here, perhaps conduct might be better, or behavior. Yeah? And so this, again, these two words are compounded to form the compound sila vata, which is we translate as rites and rituals, perhaps better translated as sometimes translated as virtue and vows, or what was another one I thought of the other day? Anyway, something like that, but it doesn't really mean attachment to rites and rituals. That's more of a, it's actually betraying a kind of modernist Buddhist critique of traditional Buddhism more than it has to do with what the words actually mean. And he's developing the kukara chittang, okay, so the mind of a dog. Okay, so he's not only developing the practice and the habits of a dog, he's developing the mind of a dog, the chitta of a dog.
Well, that's a little puzzling.
Well, he thinks like a dog.
Well, how does one know how a dog thinks?
Well, he's the Buddha.
What?
This is the Buddha talking now.
Oh.
Oh, you don't argue with the Buddha now.
No, you can slay me if you
no. That's okay, we'll just make you live like a dog for a while. Okay, and the dog behavior, fully and uninterruptedly, kukura kappa. Okay, so again, translated as behavior. Fully and uninterruptedly. Abhokirnang, paripurnang, fully abhokirnang, uninterruptedly. And having done so, on the dissolution of the body after death, he reappears in the company of dogs. Oh dear. Okay. Kaisa bheda paramarana kukuranang sahavyatang upapajati. So this particular word here, it says in the company of sahavyatang, is related to the word sahaya, meaning companion, and sahaya is in the 20th century became the word that the Thai communists would use when they called each other comrade. So in a lot of places in northeast Thailand and things, you have like the Tham Sahai is the Sahai cave, the comrade's cave, of course being where the communists would hide out during the insurgency in the 70s. So this is the thing. The reason why it's interesting to note the word usage of the word here is because this word is sometimes used, it's most famously used in suttas like the Te Vija Sutta, where it's used in the sense of Brahma Sahavyata, and is sometimes translated as union with Brahma. I think if you read Morris Walsh's translation, he translates it as union with Brahma, implying some kind of mystical or cosmic union with Brahma. But actually this isn't the implication of the term. This is just meaning being born together with the dogs, okay, in the company of dogs. That's true. It doesn't actually say as a dog, but I think that's the implication. Yeah.
He couldn't be this fellow again doing the same thing
with the dogs. No, it's because it is used in that context quite regularly. It pretty certain it just means being born as a dog. Yeah. It's just an idiom, really. So, sorry, Venerable, were you going to say? Upapajati is to be reborn. Where are we? Upapajati. Sahavitang upapajati. So this is it's always used in the sense of being reborn. Well, certainly normally used in that sense. I'm not sure always, but certainly normally used in that sense. Okay. But if he has such a view as this, if he has this view, this idea, okay, iminahang silena va vatena va tapena va brahmacharyena va, by means of this sila, okay, so by means of this conduct or behavior, or by means of this vow, this vata, or by means of this tapas, okay, this austerity, or by means of this holy life, this brahmacharya, I will become bhavisami, okay, future tense from to be, which here, as again, very commonly is used in the sense of to be reborn. I will be born as a deva, devanyatarova. Okay, so deva, obviously, is a god, and anyatara means one of, or a certain one of. So this is an idiom meaning one or other of the gods. Okay? I'll be born as one or other kind of god.
It's interesting that austerity is such a big thing throughout a lot of religions.
Oh.
And that, you know, Christian and Indian,
yep,
and Japanese Buddhism,
yep,
and various things,
yep,
have such an idea that by tormenting myself I attain some kind of spiritual...
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, ultimately, that kind of thinking comes down to a kind of dualistic thinking where you come from a sacrifice, yeah. But from a dualistic idea where you're opposing the body and the mind. And so you think by torturing the body I can free the mind. Yeah. But yeah, also as you say quite rightly, culturally as a descent from various kind of sacrificial practices. So if you have this idea, then that is wrong view. Sasahoti michaditi. And now there are two destinations of one with wrong view, I say, hell or the animal realm. So Punna, if his dog duty succeeds, it will lead him to the company of dogs. If it fails, it will lead him to hell.
Which number are we up to? I've lost it.
At the end of number 3, just before paragraph.
Oh, thanks.
So, there you go. So this is why obviously the Buddha was a bit reluctant to say anything. And so you can see he doesn't go around hell-mongering. He's not trying to put the fear of... And this is not the only case. There's other cases where the similar thing happens. And so he tries to... He doesn't want to upset people. So... when he's pressed and pushed, then he'll just sort of lay it straight down on the line. So it's interesting that he makes that twofold division. One is the actual doing of the practice of being a dog, and that leads you to become a dog. That's fair enough. And then the other one is the wrong view. Okay, so wrong view, of course, being a complex notion. But here being conscious and clearly developed, dare I say the word, dogmatic, insistence, assertion on the nature of karma, okay, karma and rebirth, which has obviously got it completely wrong, okay? So the problem with this is that it then undermines the possibility of an ethical life, because you're insisting on a view which is ultimately counter to ethics. Because if you're saying, well, the more you're like a dog, then you're going to go to heaven and be reborn as a deva and so on, then obviously you're encouraging people to behave like dogs, and dogs don't always necessarily have very good ethics. Yeah, it's not to say anything bad about dogs, sometimes they have very good ethics, but sometimes they're not very ethical. And so if you encourage people to behave like dogs, then this is going to lead to harm. And so this is why this kind of wrong view. So it would be wrong to imply from this that any kind of wrong view necessarily leads to hell, or that just having it's not a matter of just having an opinion. This is obviously a very firmly fixed dogmatic standpoint. It's not just that he thinks that this is such or like that, but obviously if you have, you know, he's devoted his life to realizing this particular kind of view. So this is the way that you know, to remember this. It's not just an opinion that he sort of casually formed. He's actually devoted his life to carrying out this particular view, which actually is leading to harm. It's leading to his own harm right here and now. And if it's copied and you know, inspires the conduct of others, will lead others to harm as well. Okay, so that's why that particular kind of wrong view is said to have such bad results.
So what about wrong meditation methods? Is that a wrong view?
That tell people to practice like a dog?
Well, not necessarily practice like a dog, but tell them to, you know, sit there and endure pain forever, and you're burning up your past karma by doing so.
You think they're going to go to hell?
I don't know, I'm not saying that.
You're not? That's good.
Throwing it up. What does it mean to succeed or fail? What success would be and what failure would be?
Well, I guess just by its results. If you know, the best possible, this means the best possible result you get is to get reborn in the dog's realm.
As a good doggy.
Yeah. But also that this is also not necessarily a prediction of his own rebirth. It's a prediction of the results of that practice. So he may not get reborn as a result of that practice. He might get reborn for some other karma that he's made, yeah, which has got nothing to do with his dog duty. Said maybe he's performed an act of kindness before, and then that will condition his rebirth. Yeah. So this is why the complexities of karma. So this is not predicting that he will definitely be reborn as a dog or not. But if that's why it says if the dog duty is successful or if it fails. It's saying if that dog duty karma is actually operative at the time of his death, then this is what will happen.
And you'll be a dog.
You'll either be a dog or go to hell.
If it fails, of course, he goes to hell.
Yeah.
Because he had a wrong view about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if he is a nice doggy and goes to a nice family, and then his karma might change altogether.
Know how many
master
members look after dogs in India?
Oh, some of them do, I'm sure.
So the failure
rescues kids that are drowning.
Don't get hung up on the word successful and failure. You have to understand what it means from the context. It just means it's the word is sampajja, some having a sampajja. Pajja having a meaning of like attaining or something like that, or reaching or being in a certain state, and some being good, and then we being the opposite of that. So if it's sort of, in other words, at its best, the best outcome is to get born here, the worst outcome is to be born there, something like that. So, yeah, it's just an idiom. Yeah, no, can he bark properly or something like that? Exactly, yes, no, it's nothing like that, no. Just saying the best possible outcome, yeah, it might be a better translation, the best outcome would be like this or like that. It's always very important to remember that the, you know, even excellent translations like Bhikkhu Bodhi's, then we have to always not get hung up in the translation.
Once he goes to hell, that's it, isn't it?
It's what?
Well, that he stays in hell.
He stays in hell?
But if he was born as a dog, he might do other things.
Does he stay in hell?
I don't know. I thought hell was hell.
Hell was hell?
Nothing. Only if you're a Catholic.
Only if you're a Catholic. Heaven and hell.
Oh, but that was
Myra. There you go. The Pope saves hell and
there you go. It's in there.
It's in there.
Is hell exothermic?
What is very chemical?
Exothermic.
Releasing energy in the form of heat.
Nikki arrives back in hell. It's my sister. My God. So,
why is this stuff about fire? Seems to be so often connected
with hell.
With this hell.
Hell good.
The ultimate truth, I guess.
The Pope's inquiry at a sermon on Sunday as to why don't we talk about hell anymore set us on the art blog thinking.
What did he say?
Well, the Pope wants us to talk about hell more often.
That was a dog in the corner before the
online diary.
Hell.
Other people can log in and read.
Right, anyway, enough. There you go, there's hell. Just in case you're wondering. No, Eva,
yes,
according to Buddhism, hell is temporary.
Really?
Yes.
Like everything else?
You've been studying Buddhism for all these years.
Well, hell, so I don't bother listening anymore.
You know that you're not going there.
Well, it talks about, in the sutras, it talks about at the end of the eon, when the world contracts, that then all the other realms disappear, including the hell, but there all the beings reborn in the devas of streaming radiance.
Yeah. Yebu
so
Yena.
How on earth does he know that the world contracts and expands?
Buddha?
Yeah.
It was a commonly held belief in that time.
It's
a standard belief in Indian cosmology. Whether it's derived from psychic powers or whatever, I'm not sure. Yeah.
It is.
So there you go, Eva. That proves from the sutras.
So hell's temporary. So you go there for a period of time. The Buddha talked about how long it is, you know. Like if you had this kind of series of 100 carts, big carts, each drawn by a team of bullocks, and each cart was filled with the sesame seeds to the very brim, and you were to take out one sesame seed every 100 years, then the line of carts would be emptied of sesame seeds long before your time in hell was over.
that would be about the worst hell for me. Teeny weeny.
There's a couple of, we'll get to look forward to a couple of suttas later in the Majjhima Nikaya which talk about hell in fairly graphic terms. So it's not something that the Buddha would go on about, but that he did mention from time to time.
And what gets you out?
Well, when the karma which sends you there is exhausted. And then some good karma which you've made previously takes over. It's serious business. Because of its seriousness, when this was said, Senia, the naked dog duty ascetic, cried out and burst into tears. Okay? Asuni Pavatesi. So. Then.
That was very undog-like behavior, really,
isn't it? I don't know. Do dogs cry?
Do dogs cry?
Well,
he greeted the Buddhist. That's kind of. Not that the same. That's just dinner for you, James.
When this was said, and he burst out in tears, and then the Blessed One told Purna, son of the Kaulians, the dog duty ascetic, Purna, I could not persuade you, and I said, enough, Purna, let that be, do not ask me that. Then Seni, the naked dog duty ascetic, said, Venerable Sir, I'm not crying because the Blessed One has said this about me, but because I have long taken up and practiced this dog duty. Venerable Sir, this Purna, son of the Kaulians, is an ox duty ascetic. He has long taken up and practiced that ox duty. What will be his destination? What will be his future course? I'm not quite sure why Bhikkhu Bodhi translated that there's ox in this case. It's actually just go, which is the ordinary word for cow. It's actually etymologically the same as the English word cow.
Probably some obscure go like a cow.
I suppose cow duty doesn't sound as good as ox duty.
Perhaps, yeah. It's subjective, isn't it? So, then goes through the same thing, and he tries to say, don't ask me that, and so on, and then it's the same result. And then the ox duty ascetic, Purna, cried out and burst into tears with the same response. And then Purna says, Venerable Sir, I have confidence in the Blessed One, thus the Blessed One is capable of teaching me the Dhamma in such a way that I can abandon this ox duty, and that this Senia, the naked dog duty ascetic, can abandon that dog duty. And Purna, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Purna, there are... So now, chapter, paragraph 7, those who can't catch up with the missing out the repetitions. There are four kinds of action, okay? So four kinds of karma. Chattari mani, kamani. So four kinds of karma. Proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. So this is a useful point to bear in mind. It's sometimes claimed that when the Buddha spoke about karma that he was just kind of picking up the views which were common in India at the time, and that he was just sort of repeating the culturally accepted points of view. But actually here he's quite clearly claiming to that he's teaching karma abhinya sachikatva, having realized with his own direct knowledge. And that's not a one-off phrase. Is in fact says that quite repeatedly and emphatically in many different cases. As somebody who, if you study the history of Indian Buddhism, of Indian religion, you would know that actually the doctrine of karma was not, at the time of the Buddha, a universally accepted teaching among Indian religious systems, and specifically among the Samana systems, of which the Buddha was one. And quite a few of them explicitly rejected the doctrine of karma, and just as the Buddha was very confident to reject prevailing beliefs at his own time in other respects, I'm sure he would have been confident enough to reject that if he felt that it was worth rejecting. So also if you look in the whole Vedic tradition, there's no mention of karma in the old strata of the Vedic Brahmanical tradition, and only in the texts which start to appear shortly before the Buddha do we find the teaching on karma mentioned one or two places. And even in the Briharanyaka Upanishad, it's mentioned, kamba is mentioned, but then the person who mentions it, he said, okay, we have this exposition, this is a secret teaching, well, and he takes him by the arm and leads him to one side and teaches him in private. Okay, so at that time, which is only shortly before the Buddha, the doctrine of kamba was already regarded as an esoteric, was still regarded as an esoteric secret teaching in the Upanishadic tradition, as inherited from the Vedic tradition. So the situation at the time of the Buddha was that certain religious groups accepted the teaching on kamma, certain ones didn't, and that they had various interpretations of the meaning of kamma and so on and so forth. And so the Buddha was born into this very diverse, appeared in this very diverse religious system, religious environment. And as he said here, he wasn't satisfied. Of course, he picked up many things from the cultural background that he was born, as we all do. But in terms of the central platforms of the religion, he would not be satisfied just to repeat what was said around him, but would only teach something as being an important part of his religion, as he says here, Maya sayang abhinya sachikatva pavedetani. I made it known after realizing for myself with my own direct knowledge. Okay. Where are we now? Thank you. Four kinds. What four? There is dark action with dark result, bright action with bright result, dark and bright action with dark and bright result, and action that is neither dark nor bright with neither dark nor bright result. Action that leads to the destruction of action. So kamma that leads to the ending of kamma. And here again, kaya, as I've said many times, does not mean destruction. It means like the ending or the finishing. It's a much more gentle word than destruction. It means to the running out of kamma, the wearing out of kamma, the using up of kamma.
In this case, it means action, not the results of action.
Exactly, yeah. So you're not destroying, yes, you're not destroying
the
stored up kamma, yeah. Exactly, but you stop making the kamma which would lead to rebirth in the future. Yeah. Okay. And katamancha purna, kamang kanhang kanhavi pakang. What purna is kamma which is dark with dark result? Here purna, a certain person makes bodily action, activity of volition, which is together with affliction, okay, afflictive. And he makes verbal action that's afflictive, and he makes mental volition that's afflictive, okay. And having made those actions, he is born in an afflictive world. Okay. When he's reappeared in an afflictive world, afflictive contacts touch him. Being touched by afflictive contacts, he feels afflictive feelings, exclusively painful, such as the case of beings in hell. Okay. Being touched by afflictive, thus a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. This is a slightly purna bhuta bhuta sa upapatti hoti. An interesting little idiom there. Iti ko purna, thus purna bhuta bhuta sa upapatti hoti. Due to a being, the re-rising of a being is. Okay, and so Bhikkhu Bodhi's little note here.
Just a commentary.
Beings are reborn through the actions they perform and in ways conforming to those actions. The implications of this thesis are explored more fully in Majjhima 135 and 136, the two Kamma Vibhanga suttas.
What does afflictive actually mean?
Causing pain, harmful.
And because of their afflictive actions, they're born in an afflictive place.
Yeah.
Causing a bad thing to be done to someone.
or to yourself, yeah?
Afflicted.
Yeah, and something that's causing pain or harmful. So the important thing here, always to notice here, so a couple of things to notice. Okay, so the Buddha starts out talking about karma, okay, as an action. Now then, here someone generates an afflictive bodily formation according to Bhikkhu Bodhi's Buddhist hybrid English in this particular passage. You don't how do you generate a formation?
Yeah.
This is just Buddhist hybrid English. Sankhara doesn't mean formation, and it's a wrong translation. I've argued about that, I've given up. Anyway, it means activity, or in this case it means volition. Okay? So sankhara is always defined as being equivalent to volition. It means the creative or constructive forces in the mind. Okay? This is what it means. Right? And it's used, you can see it's used, one kind of karma is they're all the sankharas. So karma and sankhara are identical. Okay? So what kind of karma is this? And then these three kinds of sankhara. So each sankhara is a kind of karma. Actually, sankhara and karma are from the same root. Okay? They have exactly the same roots and basically exactly the same meaning. It's a rubbish translation.
So it's a habit pattern, kind of, would that be a closer translation?
It doesn't have to be a habit pattern, it's just an act. It can be. It could be. It may not necessarily be. It sometimes is translated that way, and I think it maybe is used in that way in certain Indic idioms, but it doesn't often, it doesn't normally in Pali.
A particular incident it's referring to, an overall kind of picture.
What is it again? Sankhara, it's from the root karoti, to do. So it's just an act, a doing. So one does a doing with the body.
So people understand that Bhikkhu Bodhi tries to keep everything the same. One word in Pali has the same translation every single time into English. That's his policy. So
he tries to do that, yeah.
So when he tries to do it in all cases, it doesn't work, like in this case.
Yeah.
If you say the bodily sankhara, what's another case where it actually means formation?
I don't think it anywhere means formation.
Mental formation, and then it's bodily mental formation.
The problem is, okay, so the reason, so we'll discuss the translation of sankhara. Okay, sankhara is from the root to do, okay, and sang means together. So it's literally the same as the English word confection. Okay, fect being the root to do, and con together. So confection, so one makes lollies.
Let's be serious.
Being serious. And the translation confection was proposed by T.W. Rhys Davids, one of the greatest Pali scholars ever, for sankharas. This is not a joke.
Well, the word confection for sankhara.
Well,
you can think of it this way.
Every single time you reach out for some confectionaries, you can think that this is sankhara, this is the karma.
Yeah, absolutely.
The reaching out, the karma, the wanting, intention to.
But it's used in this, it's used in different contexts. It's used, both sankhara and karma are used in a ritual context, which is very important to understand. So they're both used to refer to the Vedic rituals. In other words, by doing this act, okay, by doing this ritual act, what you do and how that came to be interpreted was that you're actually focusing your mind and focusing your mental energy and creating a force which has an effect. Okay, so this is the important thing. You're creating a force which has an effect. And that's in Indian religion, it was always emphasized that force, that creative effect, was always primarily governed by the ritual, so that would control even the gods. And the gods got where they were by doing rituals in the beginning, okay? Whereas in Western cultures, it tended to be the other way around, that the rituals had their effect because of the grace of a god, right? Whereas in Indian culture, it was the other way around. So in the Bible, the creative force is from the god. So when God says, let there be light, that is a sankhara, Okay, that's like the primary sankhara. Okay, it's a creative force which is entering into the world. So this is exactly what kaya sankhara is, and the sankharas are, is that they're creative forces or energies which construct the world as we know it today. Okay? And they do that in a continuous fashion, but they're not doing it from outside the world in a one-off fashion, they're doing it inside in a continuous fashion. Okay, so it's a continuous creation. Alright? The forces that are shaping the world.
So how does that translation come about of formations?
Formations. Formations as a translation comes about from an Abhidhamma background, where you have a postulation that there are two senses of sankhara. One is the active sense, which is obviously present here, and which I think is certainly present in almost all cases where sankhara is used. But according to the Abhidhamma, it's also used in a passive sense to mean those things that are conditioned.
Right.
So those things that are created. Yeah, so in the case like anicca-vatta sankhara, it would be interpreted as meaning that the created conditions, conditioned things. Also in sabbe sankhara anicca would be the created things.
So it's
conditioned
like
the
chair
things.
Or the mind created things?
Both.
Of course. So
yeah.
It's losing sight of the kind of fluidity of everything.
Exactly, yeah.
And making things concrete.
So
yep,
the formations
yep.
comes from the chair part, is that what you mean? Like
from
the
passive side.
Right.
Doesn't have to be physical,
yeah.
But it's just whatever is created,
mm-hmm.
the created things rather than creative force. Yeah, and so it's relying on that issue, that question of the created things that the question, the rendering of formations came to be. Even then, it's a somewhat obscure rendering, but the attempt was to, because in English, if you say the formation of something in a singular sense. It can actually have an active sense, you see, so the formation of this particular society or something. And so the attempt was to try to capture both the passive and the active meanings in one rendering. But it just doesn't really work, because when you say formations in a context like this, it just doesn't come across as having any kind of active sense at all. It just doesn't really mean anything. So other translate, I prefer activities for sankhara. That's what I usually use. Okay, water uses forces.
But the simple root is karoti.
Karoti to do, yeah. So it's useful to know that, so that when you're reading the Buddhist texts, these are very important technical terms. And again, to avoid what we mentioned a little bit earlier, is to not get hung up on the translation. It's actually a very simple word, but it's because it's so important in Buddhist philosophy, and it doesn't really have an exact English correlate. So Bhikkhu Bodhi was going to use, in his Samyutta Nikaya, he was going to use constructions. And it is actually used in that sense also, to construct a building is to sankhara a building. Okay. But he then changed his mind on that one. That was creative forces, maybe? Anyway. Abhisankara. Abhisankara is basically just means the same thing. I mean, theoretically you'd say it's an intensification, but it really just means the same thing. Yeah, that's used in the house builder verses, Eva, you know, when the Buddha was newly enlightened. And he said that I've seen the house builder, I've destroyed the house now, I've knocked down the ridgepole and everything. So it says, visankhara gatang chittang, and now the chitta is now deconstructed. Yeah. Okay.
How about that,
eh? It's not a jit term,
no. Whatever it is. And what bona is bright action with bright result? Here someone generates an unafflictive bodily formation. I mean, how can you read this kind of thing? He performs an unafflictive bodily act. verbal and mental formation, and it similarly reappears in an unafflictive world where unafflictive contacts, and then he feels unafflictive feelings. So it sounds a bit mundane when you say it's an unafflictive feeling. It doesn't sound like Zamarata, it's like unafflictive. But then it says, Seyatapi Deva Subhakirna, such as the gods of refulgent glory. So that sounds pretty good, unafflictive. So often in Buddhism, it shows that often the kind of the idiom is phrased in a negative term, but it actually has quite a positive meaning.
Rather than sila being something that you positively do,
yeah,
something that you refrain from instead of some kind of positive action that you do, which you kind of, you know, talked against or pointed out.
Yeah.
But doesn't necessarily mean that.
It's not meant to mean that, no.
It's just the opposite of the negative.
Gods of refulgent glory, and there are some other gods.
Of different kinds of streaming radiance,
yes,
and all of those things.
Words.
Yeah, refulgent glory. I think that's what's refulgent glory is.
Refulgent, what does that mean?
Oh, it doesn't mean anything. It's Buddhist type of
being,
Sanskrit.
It being,
yeah, it
being
means whatever it is, it's good, yeah. I don't think I've ever heard the word refulgent apart from that. Okay, here we go. Beaming, radiating, or as if radiating light, the beaming sun, the effulgent daffodils. a radiant sunrise, a refulgent sunset.
And how do you that one? The effulgent daffodils.
the daffodils are looking particularly effulgent this morning.
I think we'll rip them up.
Okay, so on. So they're the two straightforward cases, okay? Then slightly more complex case, a dark and bright action with dark and bright result. He performs a bodily act that is both afflictive and unafflictive, a verbal act that's both afflictive and unafflictive, and a mental act. Having done that, he appears in a world that is both afflictive and unafflictive, being touched by both afflictive and unafflicted feelings, mingled pleasure and pain, as in the case of human beings and some gods and some beings in the lower realms. Okay? Seyatapi manusa ekatecha deva ekatecha vinipatika. So, for example, obviously humans. So this is probably the most common kind of context, isn't it? We often do acts that are kind of a mixture of good and bad. We were talking about this the other day, where we were, I think, in Woolwich, about, say, somebody who does dana and makes an offering with the thought of getting something. So, like, they're kind of making an investment, and when they do it, they think, oh, yeah, may I get a new Mercedes or something like that. And that's...
That's your favourite one, Chandra?
That's kind of mixed, because the giving is good, but the greed and attachment is bad. So that's black and white karma. And so that's why we get reborn as humans, and we get this kind of mixed karma and mixed result. Some devas, okay, so not all devas live in a pure... This one, the Subhakirna devas, are like a high jhana realm deva, okay? So these guys would be like ordinary devas who might have pleasant and unpleasant experiences, and there's many cases... in the suttas and so on, when it talks about devas having various kinds of mixed feelings and unpleasant feelings. Anyone think of any examples?
No. Yes, it's from the love song.
The love song?
Yeah.
So the what old Panchasika.
Yeah, he wants the girl deva.
Yeah.
But she married someone else, uh-huh. And so she couldn't have him.
Uh-huh. So he was heartbroken.
He was heartbroken.
Yeah, that's so sad. And... and there's quite a few other cases, similar cases, where either to a large or small degree, and like when they hear the teachings of the Buddha, for example, they get scared because they think that they're going to die, which is true, and so on. So they do have mixed feelings, and some vinipatika, so beings in the lower realms, how do they have mixed feelings?
Like monkeys or dolphins?
Like monkeys or dolphins? I think most animals probably have some mixed pleasure and pain, yeah. Except if you're born in a factory farm or something. And what about predators, hungry goats? I don't know, if I was born as a poltergeist, I'd have some pretty fun feelings. I used to freak everybody out. So, anyway, yeah, so certain things. So there's mixed karma. And then there's the most important one, action that is neither bright nor bright, neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright result. Action, the karma that leads to the ending of karma. Herein. Tatra. The volition for abandoning the kind of action that is dark with dark result. Okay, the volition. Chetana. Okay, so here he introduces a third term. We've had karma, we've had sankhara, and now we have chetana. So chetana normally is equivalent to karma or sankhara. Okay, three terms always used in, or usually used in an equivalent way. Karma, sankhara, and chetana, all of them meaning volition, some kind of ethical volition. But here, perhaps, and maybe this is reading too much into it, but perhaps we could understand a slight difference in the terminology here. That chetana, that karma and sankhara were used specifically in the sense of some kind of chetana, some kind of volition, which was generative of a future result. Okay? A future rebirth. Whereas chetana here is some kind of volition, it's still the same mental quality of volition, but it's not done with attachment, so it's not done, it's not actually generative of a future rebirth. So perhaps that's a slight difference in the implications of the word usage here. But that's just a suggestion. I'm not saying that it's always used consistently in that way.
So that's a good word.
Chetana, yeah. Chetana is a good word. Because normally, the Buddha said, of course, jetana hang bhikkhave kammang vadami. It is jetana that I call kamma. So normally, that they're equivalent. Okay, herein, the volition for abandoning the kind of action that is dark with dark result, the volition for abandoning the kind of action that is bright with bright result, and that the abandoning the action that's dark and bright with dark and bright result. This is called action that is neither dark nor bright with neither dark nor bright result, karma that leads to the ending of karma. Okay, so the volition for the abandoning. Okay, pahanaya. So, of course, he's not dwelling on and expanding that in this particular case, but we know very well from other cases that, of course, what is meant here is the intention and the wish to practice the Eightfold Path. And to realize the noble truths, to escape from samsara. This is what the that particular volition is.
How about in the middle of action? You know that whole idea of karma yoga, like having an even mind for the results.
Mm-hmm.
But trying your best, but whatever happens,
Yeah.
Could that kind of be?
Could that be?
And then that's kind of in the category of neither bright nor dark.
I would say that would be more like, I mean, if you're doing it properly, it would be more like sort of pure good karma, you know, because you're letting go, you don't have the greed or attachment to the results. But it would also depend on your views and the context in which you were doing it. If you could see that was within a context where you were working to do some kind of to facilitate on some kind of transcendental dimension, okay, then I think that would tend to have that kind of effect for yourself or for others. So for example, I think like the difference would be, let's say you want to set up a school in a third world country, yeah, and if you set up a school in a third world country to teach kids how to read and write and do math and so on, right? Or if you set up a school that taught them how to read and write and do math and to meditate, yeah, and to teach them sila, and to give them an understanding of Dhamma.
Well, the initial intention is very different there.
Yeah.
So that's... So, yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah. In both cases, you could do it without, with a pure heart.
Right,
yeah?
But where you're aiming is...
is higher.
It's a different
level, yeah. So in one case you're trying simply to bring people out of poverty and give them an education. In another case you're trying to bring them out of poverty, give them an education, but you're also trying to encourage them to realize nibbana. Yeah. So that would be that difference. Okay. Then, Sanya, the naked dog to you, said to the Blessed One, magnificent, venerable sir, magnificent.
Does Anson Tanisha use awesome?
Awesome, does he? That sounds good. Awesome.
Does he?
The Blessed One has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who is lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to the Blessed One for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. I would receive the going forth under the Blessed One. I would receive the full admission. Sanya, one who has formerly belonged to another sect. So this is Anya Ditya Bubba. Bubba meaning previously. Anya another. Ditya is a sect. Okay, so it doesn't mean a sect or in the sense of like a cult or something like that, but just means a religious order.
So does that mean that if someone has at some point in their life belonged to a religious order, then they have to do the probation? Because it says formally here, it doesn't say one has come, like one is coming from, in a sense, but formally.
I'm not quite sure about that. I'd have to check. This is also discussed in more detail in the Vinaya, so I'd have to look exactly at what it says there. Yeah. Who wishes to go forth in this Dhamma Vinaya and take full ordination, then they must, for 4 months, have a parivasati, have a probation. And then after the 4 month probation, if the bhikkhus are agreeable, then they will give the going forth and the full ordination into the state of being a bhikkhu. So notice here the usage of pabajenti upasampadenti as the absolutely standard usage in all the early suttas and the early Vinaya passages, that there is pabajenti upasampadenti are just used next to one another as synonyms. Okay? And it's not, as we use it today, that pabaja is the novice ordination and upasampada is the bhikkhu ordination, but one is pabajenti upasampadenti bhikkhu bhavaya, that one gets the going forth and full admission into the state of being a bhikkhu. Okay, so they're just synonyms. We can understand from the meaning of the words that the pabaja refers to leaving the household life, and upasampada refers to going into the bhikkhu's life. Okay, so they're like two halves of the same thing, but they weren't two different stages. So that's very important to understand when we're looking at, as we have been discussing, the history of ordination procedures and the way that this has been treated at different times and different stages, and the way that that's represented in the texts in different ways. Because often when we read the texts, we will assume that somebody must necessarily be a novice before they take bhikkhu ordination, but that's not the case. There's no, as far as I'm aware, no requirement of that anywhere in Vinaya. And it seems to be just derived from this idiom rather than being what they actually did. Such a stock passage, it probably not. But I recognize apicha metta pugala ve mattata vidyatati. Okay, so I recognize individual differences. So elsewhere it says that he allows them to go forth if they're Sakyans. So if they're from his own clan.
Or fire worshipping ascetics.
Or fire worshipping ascetics, is that right?
Yeah.
They're the two, because they believe in karma. Yeah. And if they're from his own family, I guess it's just favouritism, I guess. Could be because their background was known, because there are a lot of Sakyans, senior Sakyans in the Sangha, so perhaps because their background would be known, I'm not sure.
In the commentary it says, Papaja, the going forth, is mentioned here only in a loose figure of speech. In actual fact, he receives the going forth before the probationary period, and then lives on probation for 4 months before being told to receive the Sampada for
Ah, okay. So this is the commentary class. That's interesting. So that must be from a developed stage of the ordination procedure from the vineyard.
Yeah. But that means that he becomes a novice while he's on probation.
On probation, yeah. Yeah. So I think that's quite unlikely. But we can check how that was in the actual vineyard.
Yeah.
Mm. So, vineyard.
Yeah,
another 6 month project. So Pugalave Matata means that he might just decide to
let you do it
anyway if he likes you. Okay. So it wasn't kind of applied in a blanket sense. Then the Sanya said, Venerable Sir, if those who formerly belong to another sect and desire the going forth and full admission in this Dhamma and Vinaya live on probation for 4 months and then get the going forth and full admission, then I will live on probation for 4 years. If at the end of the 4 years the bhikkhus are satisfied with me, then let them give me the going forth and the full admission to the bhikkhus state. So he's not expressing his resentment with the training period. He's not trying to get out of it. He's not saying, the Buddha recognizes individual differences. Perhaps they might recognize an individual difference in my case. Yeah?
Yeah? I'll do anything.
He'll say, I'll do anything. I'm not pushing. He's not in a hurry.
We should implement this one in any Garika training.
Mm.
Yeah, you wouldn't have been saying that 2 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, take that. Right. So, Then Senia, the naked dog duty, said it received the going forth under the Blessed One and he received the full admission. Now this is interesting idiom. It's unusual that he took the going forth and admission under the Buddha. Normally the Buddha would send him over to the bhikkhus to do that. And so this is... Yes? Yes? Yes?
Didn't you say they received the going forth under the...
Did they?
Yeah.
In the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, he definitely goes to Ananda there. Okay, so we've got a dispute here. We'll resolve this at a certain time. Okay, no, needs to be checked. But
didn't he send Rahul a very good? That was in the case of the novice.
Yeah. So we'll check that. I was under the impression it was not. Anyway. But the other thing that's interesting is that it doesn't make clear the time. I mean,
no,
it looks like he says, well, you've got to go 4 months probation, but I allow it to be individual differences. And then he says, well, if you want me to go for 4 months, I'll go for 4 years. And he says, well, okay, we'll give you the ordination then. So he just gave it straight away. So that's what it seems like, but it doesn't actually make that clear. It is a stock passage. It doesn't make it clear that he gave the ordination straight away.
He might probably want to get the robes on instead of walking around and acting like a dog.
Well, that, yeah.
For 4 years.
I don't think the Buddha would have insisted that he kept on pretending to be a dog for 4 years. Yeah.
Daryl, who is now asleep, made a good comment that as a dog, if he goes around saving children, drowning children out of rivers, that's a lot of good.
That is a lot of good karma. Or like the psychic dog of the Gap, who would go down and save people's
well known for this.
Suicides. People are going to kill themselves at the Gap, and the dog who was living at the local pub would run down and save them before they were going to kill themselves.
A German shepherd, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, you're awake.
Now there's a sign on there's a sign in honour of him at the Gap. It says dogs totally prohibited, fine $200. So he gets it going forth. And then not long after his full admission, and again this idiom, not long after, is a bit vague. We're not really sure how
long.
Dwelling alone, eko, achi rupa sampanno. Okay? Achi ra is not long. Upa sampanna, gone forth, kopanayas ma, senya, indeed. But, indeed, or and indeed, venerable senya, eko, alone. Vupatato, withdrawn. Appamatto, diligent. Atapi, ardent. Just thinking that this is the masculine form of atapi, and we had our venerable atapi, the nun. I'm beginning to suspect that perhaps it shouldn't be atapi, it should be atapi me or atapi something. Anyway. So I have a thing about nuns being given masculine formed names, which happen to sound a little bit like feminine formed names, like atapi or satima and so on. Well, my friend, or sometimes in the case of monks also, like my friend Medino, who I told him years ago his name was wrong, but he sort of kept it anyway. But now I've heard that he's actually changed to Medhavi. He's in Sri Lanka, where the monks actually know Pali grammar. So I wouldn't let him be called Medino. So he's become Medhavi, which is good. Pahitato, resolute, dwelling in all his ways. And Natira Seva, in no long time. Natira, not long. Eva, really no long. Yasataya, that goal. Okay? Yasataya. Kulaputta means there's literally a son of family. Sammadeva means rightly. Samma, as in the Sammaditti and so on, of the Eightfold Path. Samma, this is not the word deva, okay? But the D is a sandhi consonant, and it's Sammadeva. It's again Eva, same Eva as we have here, meaning really,
for sure.
Absolutely, for sure. Sammadeva. Yeah. Agarasma, from the home. Anagaryang, to homelessness. Pabajanti. So if you remember during the nuns meeting, we had this discussion about the word anagarika, and I opined that the word anagarika is not used in the sense that we use it today in the Pali canon. Venerable Dhammananda opined that it was. We never actually managed to resolve that problem. But this is, I suspected what the term she was referring to was anagaryang. This is, means the state of homelessness. It's not the same as an anagarika is a homeless one. Pabajanti. Tadanuttarang. And again here, Pabajanti just means the word Pabaja we use for novices, but actually it's just meaning here ordination. Okay. Tadanuttarang, that unexcelled Brahmacharya, holy life. Pariyosana, culmination. Dipheva dhamme. So dipta means seen or visible. Eva, same eva we found here and here, so it's a quite an emphatic passage with all these evas. Dipheva dhamme. And this is a common idiom which basically means in this very life. Okay? So dipheva dhamme means in this very life. Sayang, oneself. Direct knowledge. Okay? So this is a clear knowledge or something like that. Sachikatwa. Sa aki. Gatwa, having made with one's own eyes. So this is actually the root is aki. Yeah, meaning eyes. So having seen for oneself with one's own eyes, having witnessed upasampadja vihasi. So one enters and abides in that goal. Okay? This is a very complex sentence, of course. And notice that the way that upasampadja is the same as upasampada and is used in two completely different senses. In the one sentence, one is ordained, actually having not long to have full ordination, and here is to enter and abide in that goal of the holy life. Okay.
Same way one enters and abides in jhana.
Yes, and enters and abides in the suttas, for example, which is an interesting usage. And then,
ask a question,
yeah, of course.
In the Pali Sutta at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Pali in the verse said that the Buddha abides in jhana.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah. It doesn't mean he lives in it all the time, it just means he gets it whenever he wants to.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because Jen said, that's not right because you can't speak when you're in jhana.
Yeah, no, of course, yeah, you can't. So it doesn't mean that you're living in it all the time, it just means that you're...
It's just like,
Jhana Vihari just means someone who gets jhanas whenever they want.
This is like the third jhana formula it talks about, and the noble ones claim that it's a pleasant abiding.
Pleasant
right?
Abiding, yeah, yeah. Doesn't mean you live there all the time. The word vihara often means a state, an abiding, but it's like a state, especially a state of meditation. And then one knows birth is ended, kirna, birth has run out, vusi tang brahmacharyang, that holy life is vusi. No, it means that holy life is completed. What is done, what had to be done has been done, and there is no coming back to this state of being. And elsewhere this word itata, this is one of those words which again is very idiomatic, it literally means thisness or thusness or something like that, but it's used in some places such as the Mahanidana Sutta, where it clearly means like a state of rebirth. Okay, so then an itata is like be born into the state of being a bird or a dog or an animal or something like that. Abhanyasi, one fully understands. And then Ayasma, Venerable Senia, became Hosi, was one of Anyatara, the Arahants. So you have to change the syntax quite a lot around quite a lot to make sense in English. A certain one, indeed, and or
venerable.
But I, Venerable Senia, Arahant was. Close quote.
That sentence is just like the one in the Fire Sutta that we used to chant.
It is.
The Vushi Tan.
It is, yes, absolutely.
Beautiful. Best words in the whole thing. I mean, in the whole of Majjhima. I love that.
Mm. Yeah, it's a lovely, lovely passage.
This brings up the, for me, karma. I think that it'd be good to go, at some point go over karma again, because
to go over karma again
to
isn't doing it once enough.
not so much the sutta, but I mean, as in going over to get a proper understanding of it as a whole.
As a whole.
Because, as you know, in the Pali canons, they don't have a karma sanyutta. But they're doing the Chinese, which makes everything convenient for finding out about karma and how it works and things like that.
Yeah, although it wouldn't, the Karma Sanyutta wouldn't necessarily explain everything that you wanted to know about karma. It would, I think it's essentially a collection of texts on the 10 pathways of wholesome and unwholesome action. So of course, you know, when you're asking for that, you're asking for Abhidhamma. Because that's what Abhidhamma is, yeah? Taking all the passages and collecting them. So.
But I'm not reifying it.
Not yet. That's a claim, Venerable Sarah. Are you prepared to back up that and under a philosophical review?
Like it was in the Mahakama Vibhanga Sutta, talks about when someone passes away and is reborn. It's not necessarily that just. Say someone does lots of good actions in this life, doesn't mean that they're going to be born in a good state.
Absolutely, yeah.
It talks about, depends on what ripens at that time.
Yep. So yeah, it's this very context. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, I mean, that's possible to try to do a systematic thing, but I mean, my kind of feeling is that often it's more you know, by doing it in this way and just sort of staying with the suttas and working directly from the suttas, that you don't necessarily get such a systematic approach, but you pick things up in a more natural way. I don't have any great views about which is the right way to, or wrong way to do it, but I kind of had this slight reticence when it comes to trying to systematize things too much.
It's good to do both. You have to have a real good feeling for the overall literature, and then that would go on deeper. But if you go on deeper too quickly,
I mean, there are plenty of, you know, there are plenty of books that explain about karma in general, But you know, the problem is that they usually will rely on concepts developed in the Abhidhamma commentarial period, and then of course you have the same problem as always, is that unless you know what the, how the suttas talked about it, then you're not able to judge to what extent those concepts are reliable or not.
Just like we learned here with Sankara and Karma being the same, basically the same thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But that is what you were saying that really hit me was the God idea that you had, like, you know, like, God says that there be life and there was life.
Hmm.
And that's the kind of creative force in the mind, isn't it? That we kind of intend it and then we do it, and that's kind of like the creative force of karma.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Within ourselves, I
yeah,
think.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
That's
it. Yeah.
And we reach out for that extra piece of chocolate cake or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's a creative force.
So, just to finish off today, here's one of the official funniest jokes in the world. A man walking down the street sees another man with a very big dog. See, it's relevant for the topic of our thing. One man says to the other, "Does your dog bite?" The man replies, "No, my dog doesn't bite." The man pats the dog, which then bites his hand. "Oh," he says, "I thought you said your dog didn't bite." He said, "That's not my dog."
Or it was the wolf one.
No, I wouldn't say that. And then the other one here is this has got nothing to do with the topic, but it's also supposed to be one of the world's funniest jokes. A brain and a jump lead went into the pub.
Mm-hmm.
Jump lead, like a jumper lead, you know, for light starting a car, battery, when the battery runs down in the car. The brain orders 2 pints from the barman, but the barman refuses to serve him. And the brain and the jumpling say, "You're discriminating." And he said, and the barman said, "No, I'm not." He said, "Well, you're clearly out of your head, and your friend looks like he's about to start something."
Oh, that's really good. That's like magic, right?
That's actually where they came from.
But if anyone is interested in going more to Matt Kummer, this book is very good.
Uh-huh.
Bodhi's book.
Yep.
In the Buddhist words, it talks about it. So.
Give us another one.
Another one.
This is recording, you know.
Well, it can be edited. But do you know this one? Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson go on a camping trip. Yeah? After a good dinner, they retire for the night and go to sleep. Some hours later, Holmes wakes up and nudges his faithful friend. "Watson, look up at the sky and tell me what you see." "I see millions and millions of stars, Holmes," replies Watson. "And what do you deduce from that?" Watson ponders for a minute. "Well, astronomically, it tells me that there are millions of galaxies and potentially billions of planets. Astrologically, I observe that Saturn is in Leo. Horologically, I deduce that the time is approximately 3:15. Meteorologically, I suspect that we will have a beautiful day tomorrow. Theologically, I can see that God is all-powerful and that we are a small and insignificant part of the universe." "What does it tell you, Holmes?" Holmes is silent for a minute. "Watson, you idiot," he says, "someone's stolen our tent." So there you go.
Sambuddho Bhagava Buddha.
and